the percentage of how much my choices matter is bigger. It's a bigger slice of the pie for War Machine. It's a bigger slice of the pie for Malifaux. I have a greater control over the result. What this means is they will win more of their games. The casual gamer that just wants to come along and have some fun, sure, they don't want to win all the time. It's not about winning every single game. A lot of the fun is just a playing experience. But they don't want to come to the table and just see their army just getting progressively wiped off the table with nothing happening in exchange. They don't want to see bloodbaths and massacres where they don't get to have any fun themselves, don't get to score any points.
Howdy friends, Craig here. We've got a treat. I got a chance to sit down and spend over an hour with Jamie Perkins, who's best known probably for his work on God Tier and Guild Ball. He's been really active on Twitter talking about the past, the present, and the future of tabletop gaming. So that's what we talk about. We talk about the Giant Games Workshop, what they've done right, what they've done wrong, and where they're headed. We spend a lot of time talking about smaller companies like Weird, Steamforged, Corvus Bell, Privateer Press, and how they took advantage of some of Games Workshop's missteps. Probably my favorite bit is when we talk about random number generators and player agency. You guys know how important player agency is to me, but he made me look at it a little bit of a different way. Enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're talking to Jamie Perkins, the game designer best known for his work on Guild Ball and God Tier. Now, listeners already know I'm a huge fan of his work. Guild Ball was my first non-GW game, and I never looked back after leaving. So, Jamie, welcome to the Third Floor.
Hi there, Craig. How you doing?
Good, my friend. So, first guests on the show always get the same question, which is, at some point in time, you did not play tabletop games at all. So I want to hear how you found tabletop games, and then eventually what brought you into the industry itself.
So, I've been playing tabletop games for about 22 years now. I'm 32 years of age, so I started when I was 10. Happened to be living in Australia at the time, very briefly. And I remember having my first Games Workshop sets bought for me, some Warhammer 40,000, and unwrapping those miniatures and just being excited about whatever this was. As a young kid, played with like little plastic army soldiers and stuff, as a lot of young boys do, and was just fascinated by this idea of Space Marines, thought they were really cool, thought they were amazing, and that was kind of the beginning of the hobby for me, really. So played around with things as a teenager for quite a while, and then sort of started to try out different games. Started off, again, kind of stayed within the Games Workshop circle, as a lot of early gamers do. Tried out Warhammer Fantasy Battle, tried Lord of the Rings, tried the different things they had to offer, really. And then getting into my early 20s, started to think about what kind of else is out there. What other games are there outside the Games Workshop circuit? And one of the things Games Workshop are definitely do is that because they're such a powerful sort of market leader, is that they never acknowledge the existence of any other gaming company, which when you're the market leader is a very powerful thing to do, especially when you have like such an impressive storefront. It's like so many Games Workshop stores, it keeps their community quite insular, I suppose. There's so many people that just don't know what else is out there, which is fine. But I was interested to see kind of what else there was. And I was, luckily there happened to be a press ganger, so a Privateer Press volunteer at the time, who was trying to get people into playing War Machine. So that became my sort of first non-Games Workshop experience, trying War Machine out. And being sort of an early 20s gamer from a very competitive family, and the fact that War Machine is kind of set up to enable you to play very competitively, it's an extremely clean rule set. Something very different to the stuff that I was used to seeing from Games Workshop that are kind of more hobby-based games. And it was just fantastic. It became my obsession for quite a long time. I was definitely very interested in organized play. Went to a lot of tournaments, spent my early 20s being very fortunate to be able to travel around, play at tournaments in different parts of the world. Actually came to the US a few times. Wow. To play. and helped form what's now become the World Team Championship for War Machine as well. It's an independent, sort of big multinational event. I've had a lot of fun with it. And it was through that I met Richard Loxham and Matt Hart, who are two of the two co-founders of Steamforged Games. They came up with the idea for Guild Ball, and I happened to be doing very well at War Machine. They asked me to play to help them play test Guild Ball, and they were impressed with my work. And that kind of became my door into being a professional in the industry. So I've been working within the industry for about 5 years now, and I think it's fantastic.
So out of curiosity, Jamie, you left GW Games, went into Privateer Press, and went into War Machine. You talked about a lot of things that you liked about War Machine, right? The clean rule set, that it's built for competitive play. Was there anything you missed, though, in that transition? Did you ever find yourself looking back at GW when you were, you know, neck deep into War Machine and going, you know what, I kind of missed this about, you know, 40K?
I think two things stood out to me in particular is the massive difference in storyline, because, you know, as it's often referred to in shorthand, the grim dark of Warhammer 40,000 is very appealing. It's an interesting thing to read about. Never obviously want to live there, but very interesting story to at least read about. And then you have this sort of slightly more cartoonish, I guess, story where no one really dies in War Machine. It's a different angle to take. It's very, very character driven, kind of a very safe place for them to tell this weaving story about their characters. The other thing as well is, and this was not to say that the miniatures from Privateer Press were bad at all, very good miniatures, but the miniatures from Games Workshop have always been such high quality. The kits now, they are almost showing off, honestly. The kits they put out nowadays are so high quality, such detail. The thing I find fascinating about their modern kits, even, just to sidetrack for a second, is they're that good at putting together model kits now that they hide the glue joints in like shoulder sockets. It's ridiculous. So not that the models from Privateer Press were bad, but when you're stopping playing a Games Workshop game, there's always a bit of a step down to look at something else.
Yeah, no question. And even if it's not the quality of the sculpts, because I think Privateer Press has good sculpts. I'm a big Malifaux player. I love their sculpts. But your point about being smart enough about where the joints are and where, you know, where the clippers are going to have to go and things like that. I mean, nobody comes close to GW on that. So I can completely get that. So, guys, as part of this Insider Insight series, it's my chance to talk to people that are game designers and industry people in the industry from all around the world. Now, recently on Twitter, Jamie has been posting some really interesting questions and ideas around the state of tabletop gaming and design. And I wanted to pick his brain today and talk about kind of the state of tabletop gaming yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So you posted several interesting thoughts, and I hopefully, Jamie, I'll talk you into coming in later. But one of the things that you posted I thought that was really provocative was how drastic the industry has changed in your mind over the last 10 years. And that's really what I want to talk mostly about. But I think before we talk about the last 10 years and how much changed, can you give me an idea of where you think it was 10 years ago before this drastic change that we're going to talk about happened?
Yeah, so I think what happened when this situation about 10 years ago was that Games Workshop were still the industry leader, and they were still, as they do now, setting the pace for a lot of companies out there. But they were a very different Games Workshop to the Games Workshop we have today. I would almost describe them as like a dormant company, where they'd found a routine that worked for them. They'd found a model. They definitely knew that they were the biggest fish in the pond. So they were already the trendsetters. They had found a point where they were making money, and they were just kind of seemed like they were happy to sit there. It's not as if they weren't doing anything. They're still releasing new model kits. They were still releasing new editions of the rules for the games. But there was just something, there's a bit of a spark missing. They weren't really doing much community interaction either. That was definitely very noticeable. It was the end of a kind of a very long silent period for Games Workshop. They had, I think they were called the Outriders. They'd got rid of their volunteer program a very long time before, and they weren't really engaging with their community. They were very much just putting kits out there, rinse and repeat, and they were making the money they were making. They seemed to be quite happy with that. And that kind of sets the backdrop for the environment that we're going to talk about here. Because what that allowed for is for gamers kind of like me that had come in through Games Workshop, seen Games Workshop as a gateway, had enjoyed the games they'd put out, and was wondering kind of what else is out there. They were kind of bleeding fans away to these new indie companies that were coming out. You know, you're in the early 2000s, you've got the rise of Weird having put out Malifaux. You've got the rise of Privateer Press having put out War Machine that are slowly gaining, you know, in numbers of followers. British companies, Mantic as well, for another one. Mantic famously has a number of ex-Games Workshop staff members actually leading its game design. And these companies kind of really, really benefited and flourished from the fact that Games Workshop had kind of taken their foot off the pedal a little bit. They were still industry leaders this entire time, but the fact that they were kind of happy to sit back a little bit just allowed space for these other companies to go around them. And this created a very interesting environment. And these companies that were going around them, they also decided, because they needed to be different to Games Workshop to be able to fight for their space, they also took a look at Games Workshop and saw, you control a lot of the casual markets. What we're going to do is we're going to focus on competitive play, organized play. So that was extremely strong for, if you, as you say, you played quite a lot of Malifaux, extremely strong for Privateer Press as well. They create these very interesting methods to play the game in organized play, very, very good organized play kits. I think even one of the most telling parts of this period as well is that one of the biggest board game companies, or most successful board game companies out there, Fantasy Flight, even dipped their toe into the waters as well with their sort of board game, miniature game hybrid with X-Wing. And the moment that a company that is so confident in releasing board games steps into the marketplace as well, that is extremely telling that all the companies at the time thought there was a bit of blood in the water. There's some money to be made here because Games Workshop have taken their foot off the pedal. And that creates this very interesting place where there's such a competitive, in terms of a business environment, such a competitive atmosphere here of so many different selections to have a look at. And it's a wonderful time for independent stockists because there's so many different games people to choose from.
Yep.
Lots of money flowing through from lots of different places and lots of choice for gamers.
Well, and the other thing that was interesting about that time, too, is how restrictive Games Workshop came on distribution, right? So that they halted the ability for you to have an online cart to sell their products, which means suddenly nobody could sell online Warhammer, which opened up a huge market for other companies. And the same thing happened when they tried to really push and focus on the stores themselves, is that they made it a bigger challenge for stores to carry their product, which left shelf space, which again, is it just like you, to your point, just opened things up considerably. So guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to delve a little bit more into then the most recent 10 years at Games Workshop, because quite frankly, we can't talk about the industry without starting with them. We'll be right back.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Howdy friends, Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com, that's with one M, or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code ThirdFloorFriend, all one word, ThirdFloorFriend, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats. Like I said before the break, if we're going to talk about how much has happened in the last 10 years, we got to talk about, you know, who was the leader 10 years ago, and quite frankly, who's still the industry leader now, right? But Games Workshop has changed. So you referred to them, Jamie, as a sleeping giant. So what woke them up?
So I think that honestly they started to take notice. There's a couple of things that started to happen sort of in the early teens, I guess, where there was some, they started to do things a little bit differently. They decided we were not quite happy with what's occurring now. We want to try things a little bit differently, try and get some of this casual market back that is bleeding away. They must have seen the sales numbers, like not scarily, but they must have seen them start to downtrend to have caused such a reaction. And it didn't happen quickly. It didn't happen overnight. It happened over a couple of years. It took quite a long time for them to wake up properly, but you start to see the murmurings, around sometime around sort of 2012, 2013, when they start releasing a lot more of the box board games that are, you know, these are vehicles for miniatures they want to release. So they want to release more 40k miniatures, so they're going to release a 40k board game with some nice cool stuff like Space Hulk, classic example of that, with some nice new Terminator miniatures. And the earlier board games they released were quite plainly, obviously, just going to be vehicles for these miniatures. They didn't appear to have much thought behind the games themselves. People would very quickly take the miniatures and discard the rest.
Yep.
Again, over a period of time, that starts to change. Sort of around the time of about 2015, they start hiring game designers like James Hewitt, who starts putting a lot more thought and pushing for, you know what, these are opportunities to sell board games to people. You don't have to just sell them to these miniatures. You put a little bit more effort into it. Make the game quality just good enough that people will play it, and then suddenly you've got a so much more valuable product. It's serving two purposes instead of one. It's not just a vehicle for miniatures. It's a board game as well. And around this kind of time, you've also got Kevin Rowntree taking over as CEO. He brings in some massively new ideas for how the company's going to run. The PR machine starts waking up again. They start talking to people. They start showing an interest in people's opinions and talking to them back and forth on Facebook. That account still nowadays, whenever they do a new release, they must have some people just sat there responding to people's excellent engagement with their community.
It's incredible.
Yeah. And they're taking note of everything. They tell them, they're passing notes back and forth to the development teams, etc., for FAQs and erratas. It's fantastic. Anyway, so I'm deviating a little bit. So going back to this, to James Hewitt, where you've got some more of these board games coming out that are playable. Some of the ones that stand out particularly are Betrayal at Calthan, Gorechosen. There's games that are playable. They're not necessarily going to be like, world-breaking games, groundbreaking games, but the games that you would look at and go, you know what, I could play this. This is decent. People start taking a little bit more notice of them, and the value of all the different things that they're doing start to rise. In addition to that, and again, their community is starting to come back, they have somehow managed to find a new level for the quality of their miniatures. They've driven them up. You're like, this is already the best. This is already the best out there. And then, good Lord, some stuff like the Nagash model that they did, all of the new stuff that they're doing for Age of Sigmar is just absolutely fantastic models. Age of Sigmar itself, you know, we saw the end times happen for a fantasy battle, I think it's in 2014, which was... It, on its own, I've done a whole Twitter thread about the birth of Age of Sigmar and how what an interesting event in the gaming industry that is. It's such a controversial event for the closure of Warhammer Fantasy's battle into Age of Sigmar in itself is a fascinating topic. But the fact that they had the guts and the knowledge to do that and stick to it. It didn't even go that well. Like the release of Age of Sigmar wasn't smooth at all. Took them another couple of years to sort of, you know, work out the tweaks and work out the bugs. And it settled down.
What was interesting about that, though, Jamie, is that we saw them react, right? So they got feedback immediately on AOS, and it was very clear and concise feedback that was pretty much universal. And they adjusted, and for the first time, I think actually came as close to admitting the mistake as I'd ever seen GW do.
Yeah, absolutely. So they came out like all guns blazing. You can play with however miniatures you want. We've got these rules where you're going to be talking strangely to your opponent across the table, and points don't matter. There's no points in this game. And people go, no, this is not what we want. We enjoy army building. We enjoy, you know, putting things in their places, ticking boxes, creating armies. It's an enjoyable experience. And Games Workshop go, you know what? Okay, fine. We'll raise the bar enough for people to enjoy that side of the experience. It's still, they never lost focus. Their focus is always, we've got gorgeous miniature kits to sell you. This game is a vehicle for selling those miniature kits, and that's fine. They recognized that they needed to raise the bar for their miniature game for that to happen. They did it, and they're flying now. There's no Age of Sigmar seems to be doing fantastically well. We don't have... we don't have as much information on it as Warhammer Fantasy Battle, I guess, because again, it's a newer game. But from, you know, retail store owners that I talk to, apparently it's doing exceptionally well. Some people tell me it's selling many more times than they sold Warhammer Fantasy Battle. But that's, I wouldn't say that's necessarily credible evidence, but people I've spoken to, at least, that own retail stores, it seems to be doing very well. something else they've also done as well, they started trying to really break down this cold corporate view that people had of Games Workshop as this sort of faceless entity that they had become, of just the symbol Games Workshop. You start seeing people like Duncan Rhodes coming forwards, and you're seeing painting classes, and they're allowing people to become, you know, limited amounts of community leaders.
Yep.
And I think the thing they did most recently when they came out with, and they actually, they had a really good piece of satire when they came out with James Workshop. It's just an absolutely genius piece of marketing where they can just, they come down to your level and go, you know what, we understand that we can poke a little bit of fun of ourselves and go with it. And it's just fantastic. It's a brilliant turnaround from what they had, where they, as I said, they had this kind of cold corporate view of what the company was to now. So the other stroke of genius they had was starting to reawaken specialist games.
Yep.
So the re-release of Blood Bowl, that is possibly a game that has the strongest cult following of any game in history. The World Championships for Blood Bowl, I heard last time, hit about 1,000 people, which is just an absolutely staggering amount of people to turn up to play a miniatures game.
Well, and for it to have been dead as long as it was dead and maintained by the community, it's incredible.
Right. A huge amount of, you know, credit needs to go to the NAF organization for holding that torch for so long. Fair play to them, absolutely. And then Games Workshop noticed, you know what, we can buy into this. Cash in on the nostalgia of this, and they did so brilliantly. They recognized they didn't need to change the rules all that much. The game worked as it was. They didn't come in and go, we're going to rewrite this whole thing, we're going to come in and make small changes, and we're going to re-release brand new, again, gorgeous model kits that they can sell to people, and suddenly, bang, a game is back, and they got a new community again. And then showing their confidence a little while after that, they even start to broach into the, you know what, we now feel like we have taken back control of the casual market. So many people have come back to playing our games. We're into, you know, people are loving these hobby kits again. Let's take this a step further and release Warhammer Underworlds and actually take a step into playing competitive games with people as well. And even that was successful. Again,
yep.
Launched off the back of these really gorgeous miniatures. It's a crossover for Age of Sigmar because the miniatures can be used in both games, and the game itself, taken from the inspiration of people like James Hewitt years earlier, this is a game that isn't just a vehicle for selling more miniatures. It works on its own. People love to play it, and it now in its own right is very successful.
Yep.
We have to also take a moment to acknowledge that even though Games Workshop did a lot of things right to win this audience back, their opposition, I think, kind of let them do it a little bit too easily, I feel. So the indie companies I mentioned before, Weird, Privateer Press, Mantic, by the time that Games Workshop are really starting to wake up in sort of 2015, 2016, these companies and their games have been around for a decent amount of time. For sort of, their games are 8, 9, 10 years old at this point. And they're starting to hit this problem I've discussed on Twitter about critical mass. What I mean, the short version of that is, I guess you could call it model bloat. When a game hits a certain size, when there are just so many different releases in this game already, a new player looks at it and goes, I can't get into that. There's just too much to learn. And he immediately switches off and goes to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any of these companies really dealt with this problem effectively at all. You can probably tell me, you'd probably be a better expert on terms of Malifaux than I would be, but I remember hearing situations where if you ever wanted to play an organized play for Malifaux, you had to just bring along masses and masses of miniatures and make up a force as you're about to play the game, I believe. And for Privateer Press, they had this notion in the very early days where they said to people they would never make a model redundant, or they wouldn't specifically do the Games Workshop thing of retiring a miniature.
Right.
And for a game that's starting off, that's very powerful because someone goes, this is cool, I can invest here and I know my money is safe. But when you get sort of 8-9 years into a game's age, that starts becoming a problem because you get to sort of 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 different SKUs that a store has to put in their shop. That's a hell of a lot of shelf space. That's a heck of a lot of miniatures for people to learn how to do to even play the game. And it's intimidating. And
well, it creates problems on multiple levels, right, Jamie? You've kind of talked about it, which is from a design perspective, it creates a problem, right? Because it's difference between balancing 30 miniatures and 1,000 miniatures, and those are two different things. It creates a distribution problem. As you said, you've got so many SKUs out there, you don't know what's on the shelves, what can be on the shelves. Stores don't know what to stock, what not to stock. And if they buy wrong, then it's sitting there collecting dust, which most independent stores can't afford. And then the third thing, which I think is the biggie that you mentioned, is that a new person walking in becomes completely overwhelmed and doesn't know where to start or where to begin. And I think Games Workshop even recognized that in changing how they box things, right? Where we saw more of the two starter sets, and in the AOS, the kind of the beginner boxes and stuff like that. You can see where Games Workshop realized that's a problem as well. So taking us really to today, and if you don't want to get into this, we don't have to, or we can just touch on it. We had really something pretty groundbreaking happen recently, and that was the statement that Games Workshop put out, which if you had told me 10 years ago Games Workshop would make any type of social statement as a company,
right.
I would have been shocked. And I have to be honest with you, I read the statement, and I was surprised at the statement. So I don't know if that's something you want to talk about, if you'd like to skip over, but if you do, I'd be interested your thoughts are.
I can talk a little bit about it. I mean, the first thing is I obviously massively support the views that have been put forward there. I think what they did is the correct thing to do. But taking a slightly more cynical perspective of it, just talking about them as a business for a moment, it's a super interesting thing for Games Workshop to do. As you say, you couldn't really see them doing that sort of 10 years or so ago. And what, if you want to be super cynical about it, what it might actually represent is Games Workshop looking at their fan base and going, we think for the first time that perhaps a greater percentage of our fan base is going to be more receptive to this message than the people that are not. Ultimately, we're speculating entirely on what it was that made them make this decision, but the Games Workshop that we know is absolutely a money machine.
Yep.
Whenever they're doing anything, it is about what they think is going to make the most money. They want to get their community back. They're talking to their community. They understand that leads to making more money. And if anybody ever wants to worry about what Games Workshop think is the most important, just look at their share price and how much profit they're making year upon year. This company is an absolute money making machine, and therefore, you look at a message like this that they put out for Black Lives Matter, and you have to wonder whether that is how much of the cash behind what's going on is driving that decision. That doesn't make it. I don't think that makes it any less noble. I still believe it's the correct thing for them to do. But it's interesting to consider the motivation behind it.
Well, what I thought, and I don't disagree with you, but what I thought was interesting, what was unexpected for me, was how they ended it, which is if you don't agree with this, then this isn't the hobby for you and you should leave. And that's the part that really shocked me. Or you won't be missed, I think was the statement.
Yes.
Because it kind of pushes back on the fact that this was just a corporate decision or a financial choice on their part.
Yep, that's true. Absolutely true. And I think that particular ending, the way it was finished, I think is what really makes you question what I just said, then it might not be entirely corporate. Someone has really put in true consideration into the way that message is written, and someone has probably looked at that and gone, we need to make sure that we're not looking corporate here at all. Let's put something at the end of there. And it also comes across as being very genuine, which is fantastic. So it's a true stroke of brilliance, honestly.
Well, and you take a larger, you know, we're talking about small fish in a very big pond here, but you take a bigger picture of it. Think about it because it's not like Weird or Privateer Press putting something out, which is maybe four or five people have to look at it and approve it and say, let's go. Games Workshop is a public company and it's a large company. So you think about all of the people that looked at that, changed it, edited it, and that's where it ended up. I think is extremely revealing about the times we live in and about the industry. Now you see Wizards of the Coast on Twitter really having a bit of a fit. They have been, you know, the gun sights have been put on them as far as some of their content. And it's interesting to see how Wizards of the Coast is handling it and Dungeons & Dragons specifically. Just today, they kind of put out a mea culpa about, hey, look, we've kind of fumbled what our response to what people are complaining about and what people are talking about, and we've got some work to do. So very, very interesting. So guys, we'll take another break. When we get back from this break, we're going to then talk about the rest of the games. So over the last 10 years, I think we've seen some success stories, some fumbles, some trips, which Jamie alluded to. We're going to talk about some of the more independent companies like Privateer Press and Weird. We'll be right back. Howdy friends, here on the third floor you'll find us playing Malifaux and other games on Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marco compatible, and lighter than neoprene. These mats use a new material that almost eliminates any glare. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. Pick a mat size, pick a design, then choose an overlay like the one for Marvel Crisis Protocol or Malifaux 3rd Edition, Strats and Schemes. It's going to speed up your deployment and the placement of strategy and objective markers. Until the end of June 2020, you can use the new promo code ThirdFloor620 to get a 10% discount on your next order. In the notes, you can ask for the Third Floor Wars logo to be put on your mat for free. Again, use the promo code ThirdFloor620, that's ThirdFloor620, to get a 10% discount. All the details are in the show notes. So Jamie talked about, you know, where the opportunity was left, where the blood was in the water, where Games Workshop kind of sat back a little bit and let these smaller companies, Privateer Press, Corvus Belli, Mantic, Weird, kind of come in and figure out where they could kind of stake their claim. What I'd be interested to know, Jamie, is kind of, you see those companies have come in, they've taken advantage of that, but what has been the arc since then in your mind for these independent companies? You alluded to the fact that you think that they really ended up sitting back and letting Games Workshop come back.
Yeah, so I think that one of the critical mistakes that we haven't covered yet is how they treated their casual gamers. I can certainly talk about this from a perspective of having played War Machine, that they absolutely focused on, I mentioned earlier, organized play. And in the early days of the companies when Games Workshop were this dormant sort of sleeping giant, that was the right thing to do, because you're coming in and you're going, we're different to Games Workshop. We don't focus as much on the casual play. Here's something a little bit more refined in our rule set because we spent a little bit more time on it. Something a bit tighter to play with. Here's something with a very well thought out organized play system. Let's go. And you fast forward another 10 years and then Games Workshop are going, cool, that's fine. We see your organized play systems and we're going to raise you in a ridiculous casual market. And these other companies go, well, I'm not entirely sure what to do about that because we've kind of built our whole model on going after these gamers that don't want to play casual stuff as much. And they try to come out with campaign systems. There'll be a weakness here in my knowledge when it comes to Malifaux as much, but I'm talking mostly from a Privateer Press perspective. But one of the statistics gets banded around that is very generic and doesn't apply to every game in the same way is that you will often find that it's only about 20% of your audience for a game is going to want to engage in organized play competitively. Your other 80% are a massive amount of unknowns that will just want to buy them for the hobby kits. They'll want to play on their kitchen tables at home. They will possibly even actively look at organized play and go, that's terrifying, I've heard some horror stories, I don't want to get engaged in that. These are an incredibly large and important group of people. And it's this 80% of the people that Games Workshop went, we want the biggest slice of the pie, and we want this huge group of gamers. And for these other indie companies that are focused on organized play, they don't really have anywhere near as many tools to keep hold of these people. They have their different stories. They have the different types of miniatures. They have steampunk. They have other ways of trying to entice people back. But at the core of it, when they're actually playing the game, so much of it is driven towards an organized play experience. If you think about regular gaming nights down at your gaming club or at your gaming store, people just playing pickup games. A lot of the time, people playing Malifaux or people playing War Machine and Hordes are going, I'm playing casual games, but what I'm actually doing is I'm practicing for this tournament that's coming up.
Yep.
So this organized play mindset and philosophy is filtering right down into your weekly gaming stores. And this actually turns out to be a massive weakness for all these indie companies. Because as I say, they don't have an answer to people that just want to go, I don't want to play tournament settings all the time. I want to play this campaign. I want to play with my Blood Angels Death Company army because it seems cool, even though it's not going to win very often. You know, I want to play with something a bit more story driven.
So out of curiosity, because we talk about it in the abstract, right? And I agree. I think that that's where, you know, a lot of these indie games found their inroads is focusing on what Games Workshop wasn't focusing on. But trying to figure out the way to ask this question, Jamie. Why would a casual gamer not be interested, or what is a casual gamer looking for? I'm having a hard time thinking maybe what Weird could do to gather more casual gamers, or Privateer Press could do, because I don't know if it's a campaign system, because Games Workshop doesn't really have a campaign system, right? So in your mind, like, what maybe is turning casual gamers off? Is it because the table was set as competitive and it's remained competitive?
It's a really difficult thing. It's a few elements that combine together. So the first one is going to be how the game itself plays. So one of the things that gamers, especially gamers that talk about competitions quite a lot, so being having a strong organized play background myself, I definitely once held this opinion, is a gamer like this with this mindset will look at a rule set and go, the percentage of how much my choices matter is bigger. It's a bigger slice of the pie for War Machine. It's a bigger slice of the pie for Malifaux. I have a greater control over the result. What this means is they will win more of their games. The casual gamer that just wants to come along and have some fun, sure, they don't want to win all the time. It's not about winning every single game. A lot of the fun is just a playing experience. But they don't want to come to the table and just see their army just getting progressively wiped off the table with nothing happening in exchange. They don't want to see bloodbaths and massacres where they don't get to have any fun themselves, don't get to score any points. And the problem is this can happen in more competitive gaming systems. You have these highly, again, this is where the time that these games have existed really plays against them, because you've got gaming systems where you've got 8-10 year veterans that know exactly how this gaming system works. They know the meta game. They know this is how the game looks like it plays, but this is how it actually plays. And I'm going to sit here for 2 hours and I'm going to very slowly remove your models and you're not going to enjoy it. And that's a very extreme perspective, but it is what can happen if your game is too slanted towards player choice. And there's a bogeyman word for those competitive players, which is RNG, random number generation, the randomness of the dice, how much of an impact that has on your game. Now, this is one of the things I was talking about on Twitter, and it's quite difficult to explain in detail, but what the... When I come back to that before about saying winning a game for War Machine is mostly determined by the choices you make. What you need to do to try to entice your casual players back in is to sort of widen that gap a little bit in terms of how much random number generation is playing in the game. It doesn't make it all about random number generation, because you still want your choices to matter, both on and off the table. You want army composition to matter. You want your choices on the table to matter. But also, you want the capacity to just go, you know what, I'm in a bit of a corner here. I'm just going to try this one-off play that might work. It's a haymaker or Hail Mary, and let's throw it. And it might not work, but it might come off every now and then. It's what those moments create stories. And those are stories that players take away from the table. Oh, my one Imperial Guardsman killed a Baneblade with his last shot, and the story around it is that he's the last dude in his unit, and he's doing a I can't remember the rule this is called, but a standard shooter Overwatch when the tank is charging at him, and he happens to blow it up because he rolls it. And that can be a bit frustrating for your competitives, but it is fantastically amusing for your casuals, and they take those stories away and they tell them to their friends, and that's one of the things that gets them involved in playing these games. But it has to be applied carefully, as I was saying before. It can't just be all about random number generation, because I don't think that's the kind of game that even casual players want to play, because they still want their decisions to matter. You want interesting decisions to make. In addition to that, you've also got there's also a bigger focus on the miniatures themselves. When Games Workshop really stepped up their miniature quality, it's something else that properly turned people's heads. I mean, I haven't bought a Games Workshop kit for a few years now, but even I had my head turned by these sort of the Lumineth kits they were putting out recently. They're absolutely stunning. And when we fast forward to real modern times, just to talk a little bit, I know we're going to get onto COVID later, but it's fascinating to me how perfectly positioned Games Workshop were for operating under a pandemic, because you don't need to play their games. You just need to go, here's a cool kit for you to put together and to paint, and you can paint up an army whilst you're stuck at home. And that's, people are going, fantastic, this is brilliant. And the other games that are out there don't quite have that same appeal. They have nice miniatures. There's a capacity to be able to convert them. But this difference in miniature quality really, really shows at moments like that.
So here's a quick thought for you, Jamie. I'd be curious to know what your thought is. So I dabbled in War Machine. By no means am I experienced in it, but I know a lot of ex-War Machine players have moved over to Malifaux. So a lot of the people I interact with now used to play War Machine. And one of the things that I hear from them a lot is how meta knowledge was such a decisive part of whether you won or lost the game, that it was not necessarily the better player, but the player that knew the meta, knew the models the best, would do well. And I think Malifaux, up to the end of second edition, was facing that same problem, and they did a pretty good job of fixing it with third edition, but the problem's going to pop up again just by the nature of how the game is designed. Do you think that, I mean, I would imagine that's a huge turnoff for casual players, and did you see that as a problem with War Machine?
Yes. You're talking about I know what you're talking about. So existing knowledge of the game being an issue for against new players, that's very difficult to overcome, and it plays into this idea I've talked about before of model bloat critical mass, and this sort of this idea that you have a a huge amount of knowledge that you, a burden that you need to take on before you can start to be competitive and win at a game. That's, it's really difficult to overcome with that, because if you, one of the options is to go, our game is unbalanced. We need to release a balance errata, or we're not happy with the way this game is being played. We're going to release an update. As a side note, I'm someone that believes that updates to a miniatures game are a necessary evil. They're something that needs to happen. There's just so many moving parts. There's going to be, speaking as someone of experience of game development, there's going to, no matter how hard you try, there's going to be some unforeseen combinations that someone is going to be fantastic and spot, and you need to be able to modify those on the fly. So it's something that we, in a perfect world, wouldn't exist, but it's a necessary evil.
Yep.
If you do that too often, if you make changes to your game too often, that's also going to put off your casual player, because if I'm someone that plays a game twice a week and I'm hooked into all the social media and I spot the updates and I go to tournaments, I'm going to be like, cool, this is fantastic. I knew about this the day it came out. I probably knew about it beforehand because we had some warning. I'm already in. We're updated. Let's go. Instead, I'm a gamer that plays, I have a busy family life. I play maybe once a month, maybe less. And I come back to the game and go, everything has changed. Everything is different. I have to relearn everything I thought I knew. Massive turnoff again. Let's go to something else that updates slightly less frequently. So it's, there isn't a perfect fix to it, because people can get so disenfranchised with regular updates.
Well, here's a question for you then, because I'm starting to hear this about Games Workshop. So the main reason I left Games Workshop is I couldn't keep track of what the hell was going on. They were releasing new books that had new rules, core game rules, not just codexes that brought in a new army or updated an army. They were putting out books and materials that were changing the rules, and they were going from edition to edition so quickly that I couldn't keep up, and I ended up having a game with somebody, and you know, for whatever reason, it's important to me to know the rules of the games I'm playing. That's sure. Just a thing for me. And I got, the first time in my life, was so frustrated playing 40K that I'm like, all right, I'm done. I can't do this. I can't keep up. And I'm hearing rumblings that with the release schedule of Games Workshop now, that people are feeling a little bit of the same way. And I don't know if you're hearing the same thing or whether that's something that Games Workshop needs to be careful about as far as threatening their casual players. Or do they not give a shit?
Well, I mean, good question. But it's definitely something they need to be concerned about. Games Workshop's typical answer to this has been new edition. Everyone needs new codexes, so get excited about the codexes or codices. And we're going to throw them all out, and people are super excited about them. Then you get them all out, and people are like, well, there's now all these, there's 13, 14 books. There's an FAQ for every single one of them. There's an FAQ for the main game. There's now too much stuff. So Games Workshop answer to that is to go, new edition. Yeah. It's all out the window. Let's do this. Start over. Go again. And it keeps feeding the money machine. There's more new books coming out. They're churning out absolute masses of information all at once. And they'll just keep rinsing, repeating. This, as you kind of said, this is probably going to start to be a problem for them at some point in the next couple of years, because people are going to start to go, this is exhausting. Like, I am fully prepared to buy these new miniatures kits, but I do actually want to play this game. But I can't keep track of the FAQ documents. I can't keep track of the errata. I can't keep track of the new edition that changes every couple of years. It's working for them now, but I think that we're going to need to see another shift from Games Workshop if they want to maintain their status as the market leader again. And as you say, it's a question of how soon that happens. But for their sake, I would hope that they're aware of that. Or if not, this when the sales start to change, they'll definitely become aware of it.
Yeah, and I'm hearing this, getting back to the independent games, I'm hearing this about Infinity and War Machine as well, that Infinity and War Machine are saying, you know what, we are going to stay on top of balance. We are going to make adjustments, and we're going to put out adjustments on a very regular basis, like weekly and monthly in some cases with Infinity. And that sounds great at surface, right? You know, if you're a competitive player and you want the game to be balanced, the fact that they're listening and adjusting, and Infinity has the benefit of the app, and they're pulling in a ton of data into that app. But I'm also starting to hear players going, I can't keep up. I can't keep track. Right. I get down to the table and I might be three changes behind, the other guy's two changes behind. We're not playing the same game anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also have Community Integrated Development, or CID, from Privateer Press. And what they're actually doing there is they're going, we recognize the issue. We have decided that we don't want to take the risk of a brand new addition to make certain model kits redundant. Again, Privateer Press have always held to true to their statement. They don't want to do that with their miniatures, which is a thing. So what they're doing is they're consolidating their position around their veterans, because that is a less risky option to them. We already have these gamers. These are the gamers we already own. We kind of want to reach out to get new players, but that's a risky option because the more we do that, the more we're putting at risk these gamers we already have. So instead, yep, they've decided to go, let's create a safe bubble around these people. Let's treat them very nicely. Let's give them the updates that they want at regular. Let's keep giving them model kits that they want. The issue with that is they have chosen to completely ignore the problem of critical mass. Their game is now so large with 2,000 plus different SKUs for War Machine that new players will often look at that and go, unless I know five or six people that are already massively into this game, I can't learn this. There's just too much stuff. It's too intimidating. So they have completely shut off their access to new players. In addition to that, by the process of natural life and moving on and people's taste change, that veteran group is going to be ever decreasing.
No question. Yeah.
So if you're not getting new blood in, that means that your community, regardless of whatever else you do, no matter how well you treat this group of players, it is going to be ever shrinking. And it's a very worrying state of affairs. Now, for Privateer Press in particular, one of the things they've done more recently is they've launched a brand new game, Warcaster. Now, this is a very interesting development. They've taken a different perspective to Age of Sigmar. They haven't blown up War Machine, although if you're into the storyline of War Machine, it's very reminiscent of the End Times right now, what they're doing.
Interesting.
Where there's a lot of apocalyptic stuff going on. But they also have this new game they've already announced, and they've actually created a story link between the two. They've actually kind of made references to how the story of War Machine, there's something to do with they're all racing towards a portal to leave the planet, and that leads to where Warcaster is happening, the new game that they've made. So that's, yeah. So, and what I hope for their sake that they're doing with their business is that they're trying to taper off War Machine and rise up with Warcaster and have Warcaster take over. This will mean that if they're doing this, that War Machine will end at some point in the next few years. I think that would honestly be a risky move, but it's one that they need to do, because if they don't shift from this very small ball of ever-decreasing veterans, they're just going to run out of money at some point in the next few years, because there's going to be no one left. They need to try and make new moves, and they've decided that the least risky way of doing that is to create Warcaster, create a new game.
Well, and you hear all of that echoes the whole Warhammer Fantasy, right? Because that's what Warhammer Fantasy was, the competitive version of Warhammer, and it was a small veteran player set because the price of entry was huge in the game. You needed so many models, and the rules were a lot more complicated. And that's what was happening with Warhammer Fantasy, is that group got smaller and smaller and smaller, and they weren't selling kits because the veterans already owned the kits they needed. They'd already right. painted them all up, so they weren't selling it. So you just, dust was on all of the Warhammer Fantasy stuff.
Absolutely.
It's interesting to see how Games Workshop has handled it with AOS, and then what Privateer Press is doing. I'm not familiar with Warcaster, but that's fascinating. I know that Corvus Belli is going to be putting out a kind of a light version of Infinity, with the idea of pulling in, try to get past that barrier, because the big barrier here with Infinity is that casual players and new players can't play the game because the game's so damn complicated. And supposedly now, you know, that the new version or the light version they're putting out is supposed to solve that. So that'll be interesting.
There's another interesting example to bring up here as well, which is one we also have lightly glossed over before, which is X-Wing. So X-Wing, yeah. I think, is when you take the different ways of refreshing your game when you hit this problem of critical mass, you have the Games Workshop approach of let's blow up Warhammer Fantasy and go for Age of Sigmar. And we have the resilience and the size of the company to withstand the negativity that's going to come with that. And they've done that. They've sailed through the rough seas and they're onto plain sailing. The alternative way of doing that is what Fantasy Flight did with X-Wing. So at the end of first edition, you have this very similar problem. You have three factions with an absolute bucket load of ships per faction, with a ton of upgrade cards, very hard to keep track of, and you also have a game state that is almost diceless. I remember hearing horror stories about the fact that you could put fleets of ships together that it literally didn't matter what they rolled, because you could guarantee a certain number of hits, a certain number of evades, because of the combination yep. of upgrades they'd released. So they took a number of different approaches to that for the X-Wing 2nd edition. So they didn't blow up the game, they said, here's a brand new set of rules for all of the ships that exist. We're also going to take a really interesting step of splitting the three existing factions into seven factions. So they spotted that they didn't have enough factions in their game that was limiting the appeal of the game, so we're going to split it into seven, give people more of a variety of gaming experience of things to play against. On top of that, they created a brand new organized play format called Hyperspace, which is what they then started pushing for all of their standard tournaments, even everything up to their World Championship at first. They've wavered on it slightly because it had a bit of a pushback from veterans, but they still use Hyperspace quite a lot. And I think the idea of Hyperspace is very noble, which is, even though we've split the factions down from 3 to 7, there's still a lot of ships per faction. And it's not even, because we have some brand new factions that only have just been released. They've only got sort of like 4 or 5 ships, where you've got the older factions like Rebellion that have got more like 10, 12. So right. what we're going to do is we're going to say you can only play with 4 or 5 ships per faction. And this is what we're going to do for all of our organized play. What that immediately says to new players, because the start of second editions when I got into X-Wing, is to go, this is great. Suddenly, I only have to learn sort of 3, 4 ships per faction instead of the 12 ships for some factions and something. And it massively reduces the weight of information. I don't care about all the rest of that stuff, unless I'm playing casual games at home. That's also fine. Yep. But if I want to engage in organized play, I only have to learn this small subset of stuff. All of the upgrade cards, the stat cards, have been reduced down. If I want to get into the game, I also don't have to go fishing for first edition sets, because anything that was legal in Hyperspace tournaments, they had created a second edition set for that came with all the correct cards. It was a stroke of brilliance. So what they did in addition to that is they went and simplified the game. So they... Yeah. They came back with a massive emphasis on how well you can pilot your ships, how well you can fly your ships. Movement needs to matter. being able to get inside of arc so you can see your opponent. And they put more of an emphasis on the dice. Now, this is a fantastic example of what I was talking about before. They had a system where player choice was everything. Literally everything in the game was almost diceless. And they recognized that and went, casual players can't play this as much. We need to add some dice back into this, a capacity for a more casual player to be able to beat a veteran player if they get a little bit lucky. And that has come back in very nicely. I've even done it myself. I've played against people that are better than me, and I've just outrolled them. And it's been a bit frustrating for them, but I've been sat there laughing myself off. And other people around me have been like, this is fantastic and hilarious. And it made for a good story, right. Again, to take away from there. And I think what X-Wing is in the modern day is it's probably the best living example of how Fantasy Flight aren't really an indie company. They're pretty big, but they're one of the best examples of how a miniature game has recognized what Games Workshop has done and have managed to stabilize themselves. They had the insular issue of, we only have veterans and this is an ever decreasing pool. What they have managed to do is to go, we know we probably can't be as big as 40K, which is an interesting point in itself because they have the Star Wars license, but what they've gone is they've said, we can't exactly compete with them, but we can do what we do very well. We can create a really good game system. It's incredibly immersive. It feels like you're flying ships. The Star Wars license is hella cool. We've got a game where dice matter, but your choices also matter. So you're getting to feel intelligent. Sometimes you get a little bit lucky. It creates good stories. And they probably have one of the best all-round games right now. They're not perfect. There are complaints from people that play X-Wing, and I understand those. It's very difficult to get this thing perfect, especially because X-Wing is, again, getting to the point where it is an aged game at this point. It's been out a while. It's not perfect, but it's the closest example we have to a game that has managed to stabilize itself in the face of Games Workshop waking up and going, we're going to take this casual market back.
Yeah, well, let's stay with Fantasy Flight for just a second. What happened with Armada?
So Armada is, I love Armada. I played it for about a year, and it is an utterly fantastic game system.
I keep hearing that, but nobody plays it.
Right, here's the problem. It's got a couple of issues. One, its first issue is it only has 2 factions. It's an absolutely fantastic gaming system, but only having 2 factions gives you a very limited amount of different opposition. There are different fleets you can fly for Rebellion and for the Imperials. There's lots of different styles of fleet, but visually, you know you're only playing against 2 different factions.
Right.
The feel of it is the same. In addition to that, the cost of pre-painted miniatures is significant in terms of how you produce them. So what this has to be then passed on to the customer. With X-Wing, they kind of get around this by the mass volume that they sell. That price is probably coming down because of the order quantities that they're putting in. So they're able to pass that on to the customer. It is still quite expensive because they're pre-painted, but the price is reasonable enough for people to just go for. With Armada, individual ships cost so much money. There's a little bit of piece of plastic this large for a frigate, and it will cost you £35 or $40-$50. And it's so expensive. There's a decent secondhand market for it as well, because of players that have gone into it and have realized, I love this game, but there's no one to play, so then I've got to get rid of all my ships on eBay, so they're selling even less ships in the stores. Again, this cost is a big problem to get over. So I think that's the two biggest issues standing away with Armada. They've only got 2 factions, and the cost of each ship is huge, which is such a shame because the gaming system itself is utterly fantastic.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check it out. I don't know if I'll invest in it or not, but I keep hearing what a great game it is. So real quick, I want to just, we don't have to get into it deep. Your thoughts on Legion then?
So Legion is one I know a little bit less about. It's an interesting one because they tried to take, it was their stab at like a free movement miniatures game where they still kept their movement sticks. But you still have sort of a free directional travel, which you don't have as much in X-Wing. And I do see it being played in clubs, but I don't think it's taken off fully. It definitely seems to have done better than Rune Wars, which just seemed to have crashed and burned. But they seem to be making a real stab at it with Legion. Now, the thing I'd be interested to know about that is that they seem to drop Rune Wars very quickly, for my money. Like they put a big effort into its release. They saw it didn't go very well, and they kind of just let it go. With Legion, they haven't done that. It seemed to have a similar level of splash to Rune Wars, but they keep going with it. And I'm interested to know whether that's something they're kind of contractually obliged to do because of the Star Wars license, having to do with Disney. But they've kept going with it. They kept plugging away, and I do see people playing it. So it's one I know a little bit less about. I do see it being played. There's some very interesting concepts of the game system as well when it comes to the way they've done the scenarios and organized play. But I'm not entirely sure why it doesn't seem to be catching people's eye.
No, it's interesting. So I don't have a ton of time, but between the podcast, the YouTube channel, and, you know, loving Malifaux and playing as much Malifaux as I can, I don't have a lot of secondary games, but the two games that I have picked up secondary are Marvel Crisis Protocol and Legion. And what has been interesting to me to see what those are. Now, I haven't played Legion yet because COVID hit right when I bought my first set of miniatures there. What Marvel Crisis Protocol has done has been very interesting to me as well. And we could do a whole podcast on that kind of stuff. So, and in the sake of time, I'm just going to lock you in and say you're coming back. But let's go ahead and take a quick break. When we get back from the break, there's two things I really want to talk about. I want to talk kind of about the state of the game, right? The state of the industry right now. I want to talk a little bit about Kickstarter, and I want to talk about COVID. So we'll be right back.
Hi guys and girls, ladies and gents, I'm Kevin Smith, I'm the Southwest boy living in the southeast of the UK. I contribute $18 or £13 a month to Third Floor Wars. And why? Well, I work 50 hours a week as a supermarket manager, have three children, so in my spare time, I just want to play Foe. And if I can't do that, the next best thing is listening to the Third Floor Wars podcast. Not only do I hear about what I play and the gaps in my knowledge, but I also hear about all of the cruising tactics that I need to beat. And often how they've even performed in recent tournament reports. The online store has some great merchandise, including t-shirts and mugs to buy now to show your support. You should be a Patreon too. So pause this episode and go to patreon.com and search for Third Floor Wars, or grab the link in the show notes.
What is it worth to you to get this podcast on a weekly basis? Is it worth $1 a month? $5 a month? $20 a month? If you'd like to help support the work that we're doing here on Third Floor Wars, please go by our Patreon. We're at patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. There you can pledge at any level, any dollar amount. Whatever you give us will help us put out quality content on a regular basis and hopefully make tabletop gaming a little bit better for you every week. Hey, want to take a moment to give a shout out to our most recent patrons, Nick Cromarty, Blair Thompson, Sean Ratner, Christopher Rue, Cody Ravicki, Nathan Howe, Brian Gresham, Max Adams, and Alec Kay. The only reason we're able to put out content on a regular basis is because of you and all of our other patrons. Thanks. So it's early July when I'm recording this with Jamie, and we're now, you know, depending on where you live in the world, a couple months or several months into lockdown, which I know personally has had a huge effect. I have not played a tabletop miniature game since late February. I tried playing online. I tried playing Legion using Tabletop Simulator, Vassal for Malifaux. Actually, the only God tier I've played has been online, and all of those are well executed. And I have to say that the module for God tier and the modules for Legion are probably the better of the ones because they still look like miniatures. They still feel like miniatures. But the reason I love tabletop gaming is I like being at a tabletop with another human being at the other side. So I'd like your thoughts, Jamie. What do you think has happened to the industry over the last several months under a pandemic? And are there going to be, do you think there's going to be a hangover here? Do you think that the industry has changed permanently, whether we get a vaccine or not?
Yeah, I think that that COVID is definitely going to have a lasting impact on miniatures games. We've already seen it where people, as you said, can't get to the tabletop anymore. They're having to play with virtual equivalents, which is, it's great that they've stepped in and it's wonderful that people can still play games. But there's definitely, I mean, I've engaged with them a little bit myself as well. I remember the biggest thing I came away with from playing those games is two things. One thing you said earlier is that I'm not stood opposite another person getting to sort of have a conversation. It's great to be able to speak to people virtually, as we are, but it's not quite the same as being face-to-face with somebody else, being able to have a laugh, being able to gesture to something physically that was funny on the table. And there's also a tactile nature to these games. We like picking up miniatures. It's nice holding a tape measure, moving tokens around. There's an element I miss of just being able to pick up the little figures and go, this little dude's cool. And you just, for as good as they are, we can't do that with virtual lens. I mean, it definitely also goes to the point you said earlier about the ones that you prefer are the ones that actually make you feel like you're at a tabletop. They do look like you're picking up miniatures. That, again, also great, but it's very difficult to fully replace that. I think we keep talking about the strengths of Games Workshop, but again, I mentioned earlier, their standard business model is just happens to be so perfectly set up for surviving a pandemic, because they're saying, we're a miniatures company. We make games to facilitate selling the miniatures to you, but you know what? You're stuck inside, you can't play games, not a problem. We've got some more kits for you to build, some new help, paint up a whole new army. We're going to direct our social media and all of our community management towards what army have you painted next. And all that kind of elements. And the other companies in the industry, it's very difficult to match that because, as we said earlier, they've focused on gameplay and competitive balance and being at the table with people, and you just can't do that during the pandemic. It's a real big problem. And I think it's not going to be over anytime soon either. Like it's going to take a long time to recover. We may even see certain games slip away because companies just won't be able to survive it. I mean, we've seen what happens when games change hands under other circumstances. There was a little bit of a blip when it came to what they called the name of the game, Drop Fleet Commander and Drop Zone Commander. Yep. When they changed from to TT Combat, I think it is, as owns those licenses now. It was quite a painful transition from one company to another. We might see that happened outside of a pandemic, but we might see that kind of thing happening again. That's going to be problematic. That said, for the companies that manage to survive and come out the other end, they may come out all the stronger. It'll be interesting to see. But it's definitely going to have a lasting impact. I think we're also seeing some of these companies try and hit heavier on the games that do survive in a pandemic very well. So obviously role play games are doing fantastically well under COVID. I actually heard of something that was really interesting happening down in London. Someone I happen to know, he's running an online role play experience called Agent Venture. And what he's doing there is it's a role play gaming experience where he has actually hired actors to be available to play characters. So you have a slot, you have an allotted time, and you call in, and there are going to be NPCs that you can speak to that are actors playing a role for you for your experience, which I just think is
that's interesting.
It is. It's a very different way to take it. So, but that apparently is taken off because people can't leave their houses. So let's take an RPG experience in a different way. You also see Privateer Press leaning quite heavily into their Riot Quest game, which is a game that's can be played a little bit more casually. You need a smaller number of miniatures, so maybe it's more easy to play within your household if people don't play games as much. Something a little bit more simple. It's interesting seeing how the industry is trying to adapt.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see. I think that whether game stores survive will be big and have a huge impact on this, because you know, it's one thing to play in your basement. I think that a big draw of the game is having a game store to go to. And being able to play. And I do, I have no predictions, but I'll be very interested to see who comes out the other side of this. You know, we're losing conventions, right? Gen Con gone, Adepticon gone. And those things are part of the fuel as well. Another thing that I want to talk about is something that's relatively new, and I want your thoughts on it. You know, when we talk about Kickstarter, that's how I found Guild Ball, as I was a backer for the Kickstarter. What do you think Kickstarter has done, both good and bad?
So the uses, Kickstarter's been around, I think, in the industry for quite a little while now, maybe sort of past 10, 15 years. But the uses of Kickstarter have changed quite dramatically. So you used to see it in the old days being used to start up new companies, to start up new games. Guild Ball, fantastic example of a game that managed to transition from being at Kickstarter and funding quite well to going to retail. Side note, when that was going on and a lot of games were on Kickstarter, there weren't that many games that managed to make the transition from Kickstarter to retail. The reason for that being is that when a retail store sees a game on Kickstarter, they think, well, they're taking all of my initial sales. What do I have to benefit from this? So it's not an easy leap to make. Nowadays, and I don't know if this is necessarily linked to COVID, I think this was happening before the pandemic hit, but it's still definitely happening now, is that companies have existing games that are going back to Kickstarter, and they're using it basically as a pre-order service. It's a high-profile pre-order service, and it's a very safe way to do it, because you can go, here's a game we have, we want to know how many people are interested. We've got 5,000 people interested. Cool. All of 5,000 copies of that game, and we already have it going straight to backers. They're cutting out distributors. They're cutting out retailers, which is another problem for retail stores. And I'm going to pick on Privacy Press a little bit again, because they're doing this exactly with Warcaster. That entire game is going straight through Kickstarter. It's going through Kickstarter multiple times from multiple waves of releases, which is a bold strategy. And it just seems like they frankly seem to have given up on trying to support retail stores with their games, but that might just be that they just need that extra capital from the direct sales. But it's not, they're just them that are doing this. A number of companies that are doing this together. Games Workshop still, I don't think, are touching Kickstarter very much, and that's fine. They don't need to. They don't have to.
Yep.
But your indie companies are using this now as a bit of a crutch to go, this is a safe pre-ordering system. We kind of need this to guarantee the kind of money that's coming in, because it can be a very volatile industry in terms of the cash flow for these different companies. And it's just something that adds a little bit of stability for them. And I just think that you do see a little bit of inexperience from some people using Kickstarter, where they haven't recognized this change, and they kind of get angry and go, why are you doing this? You're an existing company, and not
that ship sailed,
right? That might have been used for Kickstarter once, but that's not what it's being used for now. I mean, it still occasionally does happen, but that's the primary use of Kickstarter now is it's effectively a glorified pre-order system.
So we can't talk about Kickstarter without talking about Cool Minis or not, CMON. I'd be curious to know what your thoughts are on CMON, both, you know, as a company, as a model, any of their games you have thoughts on?
They're super interesting. Again, they don't seem to have as strong a retail presence. They seem to be very heavily reliant on how well their games do at Kickstarter. They have launched an enormous amount of Kickstarters at this point, and they do well. They vary a little bit. They do seem to do consistently well. They absolutely got a coup by managing to hire Eric Lang. I mean, I think what he's going to do for that company, or what he's doing for that company's public or PR perspective, is absolutely magnificent. And I think without him, they would be in a worse state, genuinely. So they must have properly pushed the boat out to get him on board.
It's the only reason they've gotten my money, because I bought them early and then realized what I thought their games were garbage. Like Zombicide, I think, is garbage. I just don't enjoy the game. That's being harsh, but that's my opinion, whatever. But once they started producing good games, and Lang's a big part of that, then suddenly I'm like, yeah, you know, CMON, here's some more of my money. So, yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you'd be able to add a bit more flesh to that than I played a game of Zombicide, and again, it was kind of similar experience. This is a very basic way into Zombicide, but there are other zombie games I can play if I really want to have this kind of experience. But, you know, Eric Lang brings this wealth of experience of having made tons of games before. Just put his name on the box, it'll sell for you very well. And he's also bringing the benefit of making legitimately fantastic games on top of it. Yeah. So that's probably the best move that they have made ever.
No, I agree. So out of curiosity, and again, this might be a question you may or may not be able to answer, I'd be curious to know, what games are you playing? Or maybe what are some games you're excited to play when we can all put our masks on and go to the game store?
So
games, and it doesn't have to be miniatures. It could be board games. I'd just be interested in the games that you're really enjoying right now.
I'm a massive fan of strategic board games, like the big grandiose ones. So I've only played Twilight Imperium a couple of times in my life, because I don't think you can handle it any more than that as a human being. But if you're into strategic board games, that's known as the grandfather of strategic board games for a reason. It's worth the experience. I actually have, me and some friends are hoping to try to organize a game of Forbidden Stars, which is the 40k skin version of, I think it was a StarCraft game that was first. Yeah. At some point soon, we're going to play that by ear, depending on how things go. And we're obviously all being very careful. But strategic games are kind of where it's at for me. I love those kinds of things. A bit more low level when I'm playing sort of with my family, they need a little bit something more simple. We'll play Blood Rage. It's a very good and easy road into playing strategic games.
Speaking of lying.
Sure, absolutely. And outside that, I want to be able to get back to playing miniatures games. I miss playing Guild Ball. I miss playing God Tier and X-Wing. And I have those just sat in boxes looking at me going, please play with us. But there's no one to play with, apart from people in the house. But it's good to find a different opponent every now and then. But I'm looking forward to playing all those three. I think, just to talk about it a little bit, because we haven't talked about it much, is I think that God Tier is going to be a very interesting one to keep your eyes on as a modern miniatures game. And now take some of the things I said earlier about that fine balance between player decision making, the dice rolls matter. It's a very simple system to get hold of. It's fairly new, so it doesn't have the problem of miniature bloat. And I think this game actually manages to, it doesn't have the X-Wing license behind it, fine. It doesn't have the Star Wars license behind it, but it does a lot of the similar things that the X-Wing does in terms of it appeals to a broad amount of people. So I'd recommend that as a game to keep your eye on.
So here's my take on God Tier. It's garbage. No, I'm kidding. so I sat down and played it the first time, and a couple things stood out to me. One, very streamlined, which is, it doesn't surprise me. It's something that listeners know that I preach about you guys, the guys at Steamforged all the time, is that like Guild Ball to this day, I think is one of the best rule sets ever created. That's created problems for me with it, but later, but anyway, but God Tier again, you guys just, they nail it and they make a good solid rule system where that the width of the random number generator is there. You've got it. So you can have epic moments where things just go well for you, but player agency is still a thing. The list building aspect of it, I think is very interesting, but here was my hot take on it. And this is a huge compliment. I had a bunch of guys 3-4 years ago bring Shadespire to me and say, Craig, you're going to love this game. Cause I missed my GW miniatures. They're like, Craig, this is not 40K. It's not fantasy, but you still get to have, Warhammer miniatures, Games Workshop miniatures, but it's not, that. And so they showed me the game and I played it a couple times and I'm like, this is Magic the Gathering. This isn't a board game. This isn't a miniature game. It's a card game. And they had not been exposed to collectible card games and deck building the way I had. And so it seemed very innovative and new to them. And it just didn't catch my interest. It's a good game. I think God Tier is Shadespire done right. I think that, my first initial concern was with the hex systems. I've never liked it. Works perfect. I can't imagine playing God Tier without it. It is a miniature game. Which is just absolutely fantastic. So it's a game that I agree with you. I think is going to have a very interesting future. Because a lot of the problems that we've been talking about, a lot of things that we have said there are concerns, we don't see with God Tier out of the gate. Now, who knows where God Tier will be 5 years, 10 years from now? But it's a smart one, and it's one of the bigger buzzes that I'm hearing. So I'm with you completely on that.
Thank you for the comments.
Yeah. Is there anything, let's look in the looking glass a little bit from a design perspective. Do you have any thoughts or theories about what might be around the corner? Do you think that there's things that you're seeing now that'll be a bigger part of the industry in the future?
Good question. I think that, let's talk again, we talked quite a lot about Games Workshop. One of the things that they're going to need to do, I think, is they're going to need to recognize at some point that they perhaps need to slow down a little bit. Because I think one of the things we're going to see from the fans of Games Workshop is what they used to feel is they weren't cared about. Now they're cared about. They have this almost a drip feed is an understatement, but they've got this kind of like the fans of Games Workshop on a drip feed. If you're going to input a certain amount of money and you're getting a certain amount of high quality miniatures from us and new rules every now and then. And I just think it's happening too fast to be sustainable. So people are going to start to get exhausted from that, both financially and honestly psychologically. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they react to it. What I think they're going to do is they're going to notice this. They're going to slow down a little bit. They're going to put a little bit more time into their rule sets. And they'll probably make things slightly simpler. That's what I want to see from Games Workshop. What I want to see from the indie companies is I want to notice them recognize the issues that Games Workshop is presenting to them and to do something about it. Is to go, okay, we can't sit with this little ball of veterans anymore and keep whittling away at it. We need to take a risk and do something. And some of the companies might not survive that transition, but I think to my mind, it's better to take a chance to exist than to have a definite chance of non-existing after a period of time, because that is what's going to happen if they keep on the course that they're on. And outside that's going to be a very interesting set of times. Like X-Wing is something that is currently. As I mentioned it before, it's doing it right, but it is an aging game.
Yep.
One of the things that I think fans of Fantasy Flight are expecting to see, we mentioned Armada before, fans of Armada are expecting to see two more factions drop for that game, which is going to be another one to watch in the future. It's exciting. It's still expensive, but there could be a big difference that's made there when they double the amount of factions in the game. I still don't think it's going to get anywhere as popular as X-Wing, primarily because it's a bigger, slower game. It takes more time to play, and there's that high cost of entry that I talked about. And then also keep your eyes on Godtier. That's definitely one for the future. So that's things I expect to see.
Do you think we're going to see a trend of miniature games moving to boards versus tabletops?
It seems to be
more the God tier than the Guild Ball.
It seems to be going that way, but it's not true for all games. I mean, to come back to X-Wing and Armada for a second, they have this sort of mask of free movement, and they still use neoprene, and they still use like open table space. And I say it's a mask of free movement because they limit the movement with the moving measuring sticks and the directions in which you can travel. And that's part of what makes both games very immersive, that you feel like you're flying capital ships. You feel like you're in a dogfight with fighters. So there are still a lot, and Legion is the same as well. I don't think there's a board. You have these options here where they're kind of faking having a game board without having to have one. Then you have games like Godtier that do actually fall and have a game board. You've got Underworld Shadespire. So I think there's a trend that's going in that direction. I also think it helps you compress gaming space. This actually isn't something we've spoken about, but it's actually worth doing. Is one of the more recent trends we've seen in gamers is. It used to be about money. I remember people talking about, oh, the Games Workshop kits have put their prices up again, and this is a big problem. And people aren't talking about that as much now. You still see it occasionally, but people are like, you know what, they're expensive, fine, I want the model kit. Now people are talking about how long does it take to play a game? How easy is it to set up? If I'm playing a mass battle game, it's because I've accepted that it's going to take a long time, and I'm cool with that. But there are a lot of people that go, I want to play a game in an hour. I want something I can carry around in a small case, take it anywhere with me, take it on an internal flight to another state, take it to me on business trips, and play with a different gaming group. And it's about how quickly can I set this game up? How many times can I play this game if I want to? How much space does this take up? If you have a game that takes up the size of playing a Magic game, that is an ideal place to be. Because for your shops and stores that want to run organized play, you're competing with Magic the Gathering as something to be run in retail stores. If you've got something that takes the same amount of space, they can get the same amount of bodies through the door for ticket sales. They can run a higher number of rounds, so a higher number of players through the door. And it's all good for the retail store. So that's another trend to keep your eyes on, is games that take a small amount of space, a small amount of time to play, which is one of the massive strengths of Underworlds.
I agree, and that's what drew me to Marvel Crisis Protocol. Is, you know, again, love Malifaux, right? But Malifaux takes 2.5-3 hours to play, and every time I do it, I love it. But I'm a father. I've got, you know, all kinds of other things. I've got a full time job. I've got a podcast and stuff like that. It's harder for me to find 2.5 hours, 3 hours.
Right.
Whereas on Tuesday nights, I could, before things happen, I could grab my 5 Marvel Crisis Protocol miniatures, drive down to the store and get 2 or 3 games of it in.
Right.
Now, would it scratch that deep strategic itch that Malifaux scratches? I mean, what I love about Malifaux? No, it doesn't. Do I have a shit ton of fun playing it? I do, you know, and it's why, you know, I realized that I needed 2 games. And we'll see with Legion whether I need 3 or not. Jamie, that was fun, my friend. We're going to have to, we got a ton of stuff that we left on the table, things that you've been pining on and, on Twitter, and the listeners, you'll get a kick out of this. So I send my guests what I call the call sheet, which is kind of a breakdown of how I think the show is going to go and kind of a general outline. And I sent the first one to Jamie and he came back and he goes, yeah, there's a lot here, Craig. and I guess I didn't even really realize it, but in talking with you now, I think we've got at least one more episode to steal out of you. So Jamie, is there anything that you want to plug or any shout outs you want to give?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, thank you for having me on. I'd love to come back and do have another conversation with you. I think if people do want to follow my conversations on Twitter, you can find me at Jamie Perkins on Twitter. I'm also thinking about putting, because my the Twitter conversations have had such a great start, I'm actually thinking about putting up a blog as well. Haven't got a name for that yet, but I will let people know certainly when I do. So I want to be putting out sort of more long form articles, people that don't want to read the long Twitter threads. Other than that, have fun, keep gaming, and hopefully lockdown ends soon and people should stay safe.
Yeah, I agree, Jamie. So I'll have a link to his Twitter feed and just follow him on Twitter. It's well worth it. I look forward to each one as they come out. And then Jamie, when that blog, if you do end up putting that together, let me know so I can boost the signal.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, man. We'll catch you next time. And for those of you that stuck around to the end, thanks for listening.
Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest gaming apparel and gear. While you're there, check out how the USFO Tour is shaping up. How does your conference compare to the others in the United States? Where do you rank nationally? Get those models built, painted, and on the table so we can see you at the U.S. Masters Invitational in October of 2020. Also, rate and write a review on this podcast for us. It really helps us find people almost as cool as you are. Thanks for listening. Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the US and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes.
Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast. Muy bueno, my friend.
Yeah, if we could make a polite request to perhaps not include that bit where I just said the Legion was pre-painted, because that'll make me look a bit stupid.
Oh yeah, I'll take care of that. I'll take care of that. I'll just put it at the very beginning to start the podcast. No, that's not a problem. All right. Yeah, I think what we can probably, I don't know, do you want to combine? I'm thinking, looking at these two segments now, these two last ones we had, I'm wondering whether we have two segments worth of stuff here.
Let's have a look at this.
So we have the where we are today, which I moved Kickstarter down there. And I was kind of thinking, you know, pre-COVID, let's just talk about where we are today and where we're at. I'm going to drop the break. Let's just see where we go.
Actually, this is where, in my notes, this is where I wrote the Who section on X-Wing doing it right, so I can delete that.
And you tell me what's a good lead-in for you. Where do you want to start?
Or maybe we could just literally call out the elephant in the room and talk about gaming, now that present-day gaming with COVID.
Let's do it.
How that's changed things. So that's definitely a big marker for what's changing the industry.
Very nice. At the end of this, we might like make history interesting.
I think the interesting of the history of the game industry has been super interesting. But I mean, that kind of comes across from, I suppose, what you've read on Twitter. I talk about it because I think it's fascinating. Like it's.
I agree. It is a. I mean, I'm still stunned at the legs it's had and how popular it is today. Because quite frankly, when I got into it 20 years ago, I thought it was just going to be, it'll always remain a very niche thing. But like, you know, Space Marines and Warhammer, I mean, those are common words. Like when people ask me, when we have friends over, They're like, you know, what is this stuff? And I said, oh, it's Warhammer. They're like, oh, I've heard of Warhammer. Like, it blows my mind. All right. So what do you want the angle to be here, Jamie, talking about these independent companies?
So I was just thinking, we kind of covered a little bit of this already. We've kind of mentioned it a little bit. We can talk a little bit more. There's some points I didn't really hit very well. We can talk about like how Kickstarter has been more of a thing, specifically for miniatures games. There's been a lot of games that you come through on Kickstarter and ones that haven't made the jump from Kickstarter to retail. And also one of the things that I kind of glossed over a little bit was when it came to the failures they had, is how all these companies treated their casual markets. I think that's one of the big mistakes they made that we haven't really mentioned yet. So we've kind of covered some of it already, but there's still a few more points.
We still got some meat. All right, cool. I'll bring us in. So you think about all of the people that looked at that, changed it, edited it, and that's where it ended up, I think is extremely revealing about the times we live in and about the industry. And now, you know, why can't I think of, it's not TSR anymore. Dungeons and Dragons.
D&D? You mean Wizard of the Coast?
Wizard of the Coast. Jeez, wow, that was bad. Now you see Wizard of the Coast on Twitter. All right, that was good, my friend.
Cool. Very good. Right. Enjoying this.
Good.
So I did get a chance to listen to a little bit of your episode with Jay Little. Very interesting guy to listen to, actually.
My man loves games.
Yeah, he's got some really cool stories of meeting some big fish. Like, I still feel like, even though I've been an industry professional for 5 years, I know a reasonable amount of people now, I still feel like small fry compared to people like him, and obviously massive people like Eric Lang, etc. Yeah, they've got some stories to tell.
I've been stalking Eric. I don't know if I'll be able to land him or not, but he just got kicked off Twitter, suspended on Twitter.
Yeah, so
which is pretty nutty. But yeah, his the stuff he put, it is a shame. The stuff that Eric puts out is incredible, absolutely incredible. He's gonna be every once in a while you come across designers like that, you know, that you go, this guy's gonna, his name is gonna last like Reiner Knizia and stuff like that have lasted. That's the kind of impact he's having on the industry. Rising Sun is a really good game.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
Sorry, go. I was going to say, a big fan of Blood Rage as well.
Yeah, Blood Rage is good. I like Rising Sun better, and you can definitely tell that it's, you know, they're brothers from the same mother. But yeah, Blood Rage is great too. I like the theme of Blood Rage better. I like the mechanics of Rising Sun better.
and they're all kind of spiritual successes as well to Chaos in the Old World.
Very much so. Yep, very much so. Which actually I have never played. I've read the rule book and I've seen it played, but I've never played it, but I've heard it's also excellent.
It is good. It's good. Like, it's probably showing its age next to the other two, but it is still a very good game. It's worth playing if you get the chance to.
Yep. All right, I'll bring us back, Jamie.